Get 12 weeks of The Spectator in print and online for just £12. And we'll give you a £20 Amazon gift voucher, absolutely free. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher. Hello and welcome to The Spectator Out Loud. Each week, we pick a handful of writers from the magazine and ask them to read their pieces aloud. This week, we're joined by the actress Joanna Lumley, who recalls her meeting with the former champion wrestler of Mongolia, now the country's president, as well as the joys of eating birdseed. Then, Spectator columnist Lionel Shriver argues that the truly novel thing about the novel coronavirus is just how terrified it's made us all. Next, the satirist Andrew Doyle argues that the SNP's new hate crime bill would criminalise even the Bible. And finally, lowlife's Jeremy Clark on the sadness of seeing his neighbour selling up and moving out. First up, Joanna Lumley.
Rather like unpacking after a holiday, when you take unworn clothes from the case still neatly folded because the occasion to wear them didn't arise, unshown film sequences from my travel programmes are carefully edited and stored. The cancellation of this year's long trip along the spice route made us look at these stories again. With not much prompting, we've made three whole programmes from them. In the few years since we made these series, the world has changed. The champion wrestler in Mongolia, the softly spoken Mr. Batulga, for example, has become president of that country. He told me of his plan to build an eco-city on the plains, the streets radiating from the focal point of a colossal figure of the Buddha as a young man. We drove to the remote site. Cranes and diggers were at work, and sections of the statue lay on the grass, gleaming gold under the cobalt sky. One holy hand lay apart, each finger three times bigger than my whole body. Batulga's utopian dream may not have been realised yet, but the thought of solar-powered factories and windmills was attractive in every way. In Ulaanbaatar, Batulga's other huge monument, the immense equestrian statue of Genghis Khan, 40 metres high, stares across to the east, where he was born, near Lake Baikal, the largest freshwater lake in the world, with approximately the same amount of water as all of America's Great Lakes combined. Everything is on a different scale in Mongolia. Sunflower seed hearts are sold in our local supermarket in two different aisles. One has a small packet for human consumption. The other, marketed as bird food, is among the pet food. I buy the latter, as they are exactly the same, only much cheaper. Spread the seed hearts on a baking tray, sprinkle some soy sauce over them, rummaging them about so they're all covered, and put them in a slow oven for about 30 minutes. They should come out crispy and brown, excellent for scattering on salads or soups, or served along with crisps beside a chilled martini, preferably a Vespa, as described by James Bond in Casino Royale. Nowadays, bartenders tend to question the proportions set out by Ian Fleming, but here at home in Stockwell, we play by his rules. 3 measures of gin, 1 of vodka, and 1/2 of quina lile, shaken with ice, not stirred. For 5 nights in late July, Horse Guards Parade was occupied by film cameras, regimental bands, a choir, an orchestra, veterans, and other performers. We gathered together in the early evening. The shooting went on well into the night. The commemoration of Victory Over Japan Day, VJ Day, will be shown on BBC One on the 15th of August, 75 years to the day since the Second World War was finally over. Projected onto the buildings surrounding that vast quadrangle were photographs and film clips of veterans, jungles, aircraft, Vera Lynn, spangled stars slowly dropping down the windows and archways. We moved silently in the dark, the huge camera jibs rearing over the proceedings, flying forwards to grab a close-up, tracking sideways to show the massed musicians. Quiet groups stood round screens which showed all the shots. the sound was slightly delayed to the ear over the colossal expanse of gravelled courtyard, although microphones will have us all synchronised. My father was a Chindit, so the memories were particularly poignant. The forgotten were being recalled here in the darkness, small pools of light glowing and dying as the sequence came to an end, a tiny smattering of applause as a song finished. The distances between us made it all seem dreamlike. London was far away outside these recollections of the war in the Far East. The lights in the upper windows of 10 Downing Street shone on through the night. There is a new baby there, and lovely life goes on. We packed up in the early hours, and now the only evidence of our brief encounter remains in the film we made, and in the enduring memories of an army, once forgotten, now remembered for all time. During lockdown, I found that I had a good supply of a paint called Green Smoke. I painted a chest of drawers, two tables, and a chair, and there was still some left. For ages, I had thought that front doors in London were supposed to be black, so ours had been very dark green for nearly 30 years. Now it too is painted in green smoke, but not until I'd checked out the surrounding houses within about half a mile. Some are mauve, red, purple or grey, and one or two a fairly similar hue to my new go-to colour. So I felt safe in making the change, as we live in a conservation area. Now it looks wonderful, with the brass gleaming on the door. It's like having a haircut, or, for a heavily bearded man, a shave. The same underneath, but quite different. Ehiu fugaces postume postume labuntur anni. Blimey posthumous, doesn't time fly? Nothing has changed much since Horace wrote those words.
That was Joanna Lumley. Now, Lionel Shriver.
There's nothing unprecedented about COVID-19 itself. The equally novel, equally infectious Asian flu of 1957 had commensurate fatalities in Britain. Scaled up for today's population, the equivalent of 42,000, while the UK's statistically flawed COVID death total now stands at 46,000. Globally, the Asian flu was vastly more lethal, causing between 2 and 4 million deaths. The Hong Kong flu of 1968 to 69 also slew up to 4 million people worldwide, including 80,000 Britons. Yet in both instances, life went on. What is unprecedented? Never has a virus been so oversold. Why, I'd like to sign on with COVID's agent. What a publicity budget. In a recent KEXT CNC poll, British respondents estimated that nearly 7% of the UK population has died from the coronavirus. That would be 4.5 million people. Scots supposed that more than 10% of the UK population has died. That would be 7 million people. Astonishingly, Americans believe that COVID has killed 9% of their compatriots, or almost 30 million people. The real US total has indeed crossed the milestone of 150,000. But for pity's sake, only 20 million people died in the First World War. True, your average everyman and woman are not dab hands at statistics. Nevertheless, broadcast news has bludgeoned audiences daily with COVID death totals. And a citizenry ought to have some vague notion of their country's population. So folks convinced that in 5 meager months they've lost a tenth of their fellows, the literal meaning of the word decimate, need only drop a digit to realize how absurdly their bloated estimate compares with familiar figures on the news. But then, the public is never good with zeros, a failing which treasuries in deficit count on. Our very own Matthew Paris, many of whose columns I admire, is not immune to COVID hyperbole syndrome. His last column alludes to the virus killing millions worldwide, a phrase that sailed unmolested past pernickety editors and fact-checkers at this magazine. But the true worldwide death toll at the time was about 650,000. I'd argue for improved British education in maths, except it seems Britain doesn't do education anymore. So let's instead take those exaggerated impressions of lethality as proof of a stupendously successful propaganda campaign. The government has destroyed the country and needs to keep ramping up the hysteria, the better to keep destroying it. Boris Johnson gets a lot of stick, so it's time to give the boy credit for once. At destroying the country, he's doing a damned fine job. During events that in the present loom distortingly large, I'm always dubious of assertions that nothing will ever be the same again. Yet I worry that COVID-19 may have issued in a new intolerance for the nature of biology that could prove long-lasting. When I was a kid, there was no MMR vaccine, and children were expected to get measles, mumps, chickenpox, and rubella as a matter of course. I obligingly contracted these diseases, which were unpleasant and, I now realize, far more dangerous than my parents' blitheness would suggest. Naturally, I've also contracted flu and colds throughout my life, and I've been resigned to the fact that these disagreeable ailments were due to contact with other people. Abstractly, I've known that other people could also infect me with more deadly pathogens, whooping cough, meningitis, and TB, to name but a few. Yet, hitherto, it's never occurred to me that I should therefore wrap myself in cling film, tie a sanitary towel across my face, and lock myself in a cupboard. The more relentless these micromanaging policies of social distancing, an expression I've come to loathe, mandatory masks, continued closures, and capriciously restored regional lockdowns, apparently on the basis of a miserable uptick of 14 extra cases. The more we relocate what had lurked far at the back of our minds to the front, other people are sources of contagion. We used to live with that fact. But this ongoing risk of mixing with other human beings, we're now, apparently, to find intolerable. I'm currently in New York, where the medical paranoia is sustained and social life is nearly non-existent. This week, a rarity, a couple came inside our house. They didn't sit down, didn't stay long, and were careful not to touch anything. When they left, they were clearly relieved and immediately doused themselves in hand sanitizer. I don't think it's going to be any different next summer. Google, for example, has already advised its employees to work from home for the next 12 months. The graph of new cases in the UK roughly leveled off throughout July, but it has not plateaued at zero. The PM gives every indication that only zero will do. Thus, as long as the coronavirus persists, the fearful prophylactic measures will continue. In trade for this valiant vigilance on our behalf, we merely have to sacrifice our friends, any new friends. All live performance, music, plays, restaurants, all occasions, like proper weddings, funerals, birthdays, and extended family celebrations. Travel, colleagues, any search for love, any moving communal experience like festivals, dentistry, a functional national health service. Oh, and the economy. And in case you need translation, that means the country, full stop. Boris's nuclear option of another total national lockdown remains on the table. Why on earth? The one constructive conclusion to draw from this debacle is that long indiscriminate national lockdowns to suppress infectious disease are a catastrophe. Yet the most horrifying consequence of COVID-19 could be that lockdown, which once applied only to prisons, becomes officialdom's established knee-jerk response to any new contagion. There will be a new contagion, too, and a new one after that. How many times can you send the national debt soaring, devastate small business, paralyze government services, including health care, and cancel for months on end the civil liberties of an erstwhile free people? In preference to this repeated carpet bombing, a literal nuclear option might at least get the agony over with fast.
That was Lionel Shriver. Next, Andrew Doyle.
For the Scottish National Party, the phrase nanny state is not so much a criticism as an aspiration. This is the party that wanted to assign a state guardian to every child born in Scotland through its named person scheme, only to be thwarted by the Supreme Court. Under Nicola Sturgeon's leadership, there have been repeated attempts to regulate the eating and drinking habits of people, including proposed bans on two-for-one pizza deals and minimum pricing on cheaper alcoholic drinks. It makes sense, then, that the party's paternalism should extend to the question of free speech. Scotland's new Hate Crime and Public Order Bill was ostensibly proposed to repeal outdated prescriptions against blasphemy, but will instead usher in a range of new blasphemy laws by stealth. Most controversially, Part 2 of the bill pertains to the offence of stirring up hatred, which criminalises anyone who behaves in a threatening, abusive or insulting manner, or communicates threatening, abusive or insulting material to another person. Moreover, the bill explicitly allows for intention to be put aside. If behaviour or material is likely to stir up hatred against any protected groups, defined by age, disability, racial or ethnic identity, sexual orientation, transgender identity, or variations in sex characteristics, then whether or not the perpetrator intended to do so is immaterial. Even an actor playing a bigoted character could be prosecuted under the proposed laws. An entire section of the bill is devoted to the public performance of a play, which specifies that actors and directors can be found culpable if members of protected groups find the material offensive. So if you are troubled by the anti-Semitism of Shylock's detractors, or the Islamophobia of Tamburlaine's decision to burn the Quran, you can complain to the Scottish police. Next year's Edinburgh Festival should be interesting. The implications for stand-up comedy are similarly dire. As practitioners of an art form that often teases the limits of public tolerance, comedians frequently find themselves involved in free speech battles. The Dean of the Faculty of Advocates, Roddy Dunlop QC, has already warned that stand-up would not be exempt from the SNP's bill, and that even an old-fashioned Scotsman, Irishman and Englishman joke may be perceived as discriminatory. Certainly, some of the more subversive acts that regularly appear at Comedy Unleashed, a night I co-founded in London, would be at risk of prosecution should they venture north of the border. The bill even goes as far as to criminalise the possession of inflammatory material, which is why senior Catholic bishops have raised concerns that possession of the Bible could become a criminal offence. Let's not forget that Leviticus chapter 20 verse 13 calls for the execution of gay men. In a statement that out Donald Trump's Donald Trump, the SNP's Justice Secretary Humza Yousaf has asserted that the bill does not undermine free speech, but rather protects it. Given that this bill could see those found guilty of insulting behaviour imprisoned for 7 years, Yousaf's claim is at once hilarious and disturbing. The bill does not seek to stifle criticism or rigorous debate in any way, writes Yousaf. People will still be able to express controversial, challenging, or even offensive views as long as this is not done in a threatening or abusive way that is intended to stir up hatred or likely to stir up hatred. None of which addresses the problem of how such vague legislation is apt to be interpreted. In accordance with all official law enforcement guidance in the UK, the website for Police Scotland defines an incident or crime as hateful based on the perception of the victim, newspeak for complainant. If hatred is a matter of perception and not intent, and even the context of dramatic representation is considered irrelevant, how can we possibly safeguard against the abuse of state power? We must always be vigilant against the introduction of legislation when couched in such vague terms. Yousaf's stated conviction that free speech itself is never an unfettered right strongly suggests that the bill's ambiguity is no accident. Even the Scottish Police Federation has warned that its effects would be tantamount to the policing of what people think or feel, and the Law Society of Scotland has called it a significant threat to freedom of expressions. That the SNP seemed determined to ignore these objections may not be particularly surprising, but it should be a matter of uttermost concern for those of us who still believe in the preservation of liberal values.
That was Andrew Doyle. And finally, Jeremy Clark.
Until January, the foreign correspondent lived in a late 18th century house with a vineyard, olive grove and vegetable garden close to the village centre. You'd go through a gate and then another gate and find yourself suddenly in the countryside, being yapped at by Mary, the most spoiled and spherical spaniel in Christendom. Then by the foreign correspondent himself, who would appear in front of his lovely old house, his arms spread wide to welcome you. Usually the first thing he would say was that he was thinking about having a drink. And why didn't he go and fetch a bottle and glasses? Each year, his vineyard produced about 400 bottles of blood red wine, enough to provide him with a fairly potent staple, yet not quite enough to stimulate the interest of the French state. Some years were better than others. Others were best avoided altogether, frankly, especially those of a less than robust constitution. His annual grape harvest took him and a dozen of his friends about 2 hours to pick. The 2 hours picking would be followed by an 8-hour lunch, at the end of which, although seeing double, I believed I'd achieved the mental clarity of a Nietzsche in Turin. The foreign correspondent had had one of his kidneys shot away by a Serb marksman and could reach that sublime state in a fraction of the time. You knew he was there when he would try to subvert the laws of nature by trying to fit more wine into your already full glass, and all he had to say on any subject under discussion was, "Isn't this just great?" or "Let's fly to Mars!" He adored his house, garden and vineyard, and I thought him the happiest man alive. Occasionally he would fly somewhere on planet Earth. Then, this immaculately dressed, clean-shaven, articulate and sober alter ego would appear on television, speaking into his handheld microphone while stucking rubber bullets, cobbles or tear gas canisters. He claimed to love riots and the smell of tear gas, and I have no trouble believing it. Not long afterwards, this generous, ecstatic spirit would reappear in his earthly paradise and take up his other favourite role as a convivial, shaggy-haired peasant, and the parties would resume. Birthday parties, Christmas parties, impromptu parties, dinner parties, lunch parties, leaving parties, welcome parties, Trafalgar Days, fancy dress parties, Bastille Day parties. Any excuse. We thought it would go on forever. Then a property developer arrived in the village and began buying and developing. A holiday complex arose story by story on three sides of the foreign correspondent's small holding, and there was no longer the feeling of being in the country. Also, it became disastrously clear that the lovely old house was coveted by the property developer as a potential restaurant and wine bar and the final piece in his fantasy jigsaw. The property developer made the foreign correspondent an offer he couldn't refuse. With his seclusion compromised, and after months of agonising, he accepted the offer and moved away. I suppose it's the old, old story. The restaurant and wine bar opened for business a fortnight ago. Last night, I went to the wine bar for the first time. Strange it was to revisit and find the very human relationships one normally encountered there now a place of decorum regulated by the cash nexus. I chose to sit where we had often sat, laughed, in front of the house, facing the vineyard and the massive Aleppo pine. Looking around, I saw that the refurbishment was minimal and sort of tasteful. The ambience upgraded from rural analogue to urban digital. The seating was lower, the cushion thicker. The welcoming path was wider, the gravel smaller. Potted bay trees trained into small pyramids were dotted about. The air was so perfectly still it was like being indoors. Customers were arriving in considerable numbers along the gravel path. They were tastefully dressed, well-mannered and looked intelligent. The conversational volume level generated among the scattered tables, however, was more muted than the old place was used to. There was laughter, yes. Laughter constrained self-consciously within reason and decorum, but laughter nevertheless. foreign correspondent used to fling himself back in his chair and shout and weep with helpless laughter. We all did. He was our king. I now noticed that my glass was empty, something unheard of within the bounds of that property for many years. The overworked waiter had disappeared. My glass remained empty. Then, as it happens here in the south of France sometimes, an extraordinarily violent Pentecostal wind suddenly broke out from nowhere. Tablecloths flew, hairdos flapped, a glass shattered. The mighty Aleppo pine articulated each terrific gust like a vocal cord, swirling and hissing madly. "Blow winds and crack your cheeks," I thought ungenerously. "Rage blow."
That was Jeremy Clark. That's all for this week. If you've enjoyed any of the pieces, why not pick up a copy of The Spectator in your local socially distanced newsagent, or even better, why not subscribe to The Spectator in print and online? In fact, we're offering an introductory offer. 12 weeks for just £12 plus a £20 Amazon gift voucher. Go to www.spectator.co.uk/voucher. Thank you for listening, and I hope you'll tune in again next week.